Today on the AV Podcast, we celebrate and pay tribute to the 30th anniversary of Coming to America. Just saying that makes me feel old as hell. Shit. You know, I woke up today and I swear I had more gray hairs on my goatee than I did before I went to bed. Like, seriously, what the hell's going on, man? Anyways, I invite Andrew Mambo from ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast and DJ Keo as we discuss a wide range of topics regarding this movie, from the genius of Eddie Murphy and his dominant career arc in the 80s to our favorite scenes, the cultural parallels between 1988 and 2018. Just a bunch of topics, man. Just, we're going in different directions. You know, sit back and relax. You know, I hope you enjoy it. That's all I can say. South Shore Ave is available wherever you listen to podcasts. You can listen and subscribe to the latest episodes on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher under the name South Shore Ave. You know, you got to make sure you click and subscribe on your podcast app and rate the shows too. 5 stars. You know the drill. 5 stars. And as always, to listen to more podcast episodes and to catch up on my podcast catalog, make sure you subscribe to SouthShoreAv.com. Once again, that's SouthShoreAv.com. And one more thing. Season 3 of The Stoop is launching in July. But, you know, we got time to discuss that, you know, within the next few episodes or so. So we'll get into that later. All right? It's the AV Podcast with Cal C on South Shore Ave Radio. Aha. Aha. Listen to the podcast, your best.
Welcome to the AV Podcast with Cal C on South Shore Ave Radio.
Welcome to the AV Podcast. I've had these two guests on together on the Black Panther episode, and I decided, shit, you know what? Let's bring the band back together. I enjoy doing the show about a possibly iconic African-based movie, so why not do another one together with these guys? Let's keep that same energy going, keep it authentic, keep it fun, keep it loose, and most importantly, no auto-drafting. Ladies and gentlemen... Every time I'm still bitter. I'm still bitter. Please welcome back DJ producer DJ Keo and the producer of ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast. Let's welcome back Andrew Mambo as well. What's going on, fellas?
What's good, man? Good. What's up, bro? Thanks for having us.
No problem, man. Anytime, you know. you guys can definitely now pour your own cup of juice now. It's okay, you know.
Respect.
and Keo, yes, I'm still a little bitter about that.
That's the only person who's trying to drive you into a hell, man.
You should be bitter, bro. That was bullshit. We had to deal with that for like 3 years in a row. This guy was auto-draft win.
It's only 2 years, man. It's only 2 years.
The guy was like the Golden State Warriors on HGH when it came to that auto-drafting crap, man. It made no sense.
Garbage. Pure luck.
All right, so now, you know, I brought you guys here to talk about the 30th. I can't believe it's 30 years, man. But the 30th anniversary of Coming to America, as you know, starring Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall, Shari Headley, James Earl Jones, John Amos, and a whole bunch of other actors who were either enjoying some fame back then or were about to. What were your thoughts initially when you guys first saw this movie? Like, or what do you think about this movie?
I remember, like, when I was younger, my parents used to be super strict. And so they're like, they didn't want, like, movies with cursing and, you know, bad language and just, you know, adult themes. So, like, we all started watching the movie together. And when he started, he said, the fuck you, when he first came on, when he's in the cab. My dad was like, nope. So, like, I had to wait for, like, a year or two before I could watch it with my friends. So, like, that was my first thing. It was like, what the what? You know, you get the cultural thing, and you start the Africa stuff, you got the elephants. I was like, oh, it's a big family movie. It's going to be great. And my dad was just like, no, son, not today. That was wild.
You realize after the royal bath scene, he's like, yeah, that's probably something not a preteen can watch, right?
Yeah. Because it was rated R. Like, it was a hard R, too. It wasn't even like a regular thing, because there's a lot of cursing in this movie.
Yeah. That's vintage Eddie Murphy rated R.
Yeah. Because wasn't this whole movie based on one of his comedy? Like, he had a short thing in a comedy special. I think it was Raw or something like that.
Right.
And he's talking about getting the queen from Africa.
Yeah.
And then it just rolled from there.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to think of, like, I don't remember exactly when I first saw Coming to America, because I definitely didn't see it when it first came out.
I don't think any of us did. At least the three of us here talking, for sure. I know for sure I did.
Yeah.
I know I saw it much later. I still don't even know if my dad seen it. He'd probably like watch that and be like, what is this? You know, like, my dad's coming, the African immigrant from Tanzania is coming here watching this, and he's just like, this is absolutely ridiculous. But it's hella entertaining. And I think that, like, the one really interesting thing I thought about this movie, I remember when I first saw it, was just the idea of just, like, there is, like, a comical aspect to it, obviously. They're kind of cracking jokes and making fun of, like, ideas that people have about like Africa and what it really could be versus what it is and all these kind of things. Like, they're playing with all these kind of different ideas and concepts. But it was very cool to see a film where it's being portrayed as, you know, something positive.
Right.
Because during that time, like, if you think about it, like, what were the images you were seeing in the 80s and 90s about Africa? It was all about Ethiopia and pictures of starving children, and, you know, there's genocide happening and all these kind of things. Like,
right.
It's all war and Liberia and
apartheid, so all that stuff.
To see like a positive image. If you really break it down, you're like, obviously these people were dictators and abusing all the money of the country for their own family's personal pleasure. Which, so it's like horrible in one sense. But in reality, when you look at it on the surface, it's like this, like, you know, kind of beautiful portrayal of Africa, or the ideal, like, you know, of what it could be. Yeah, it was. That, I remember that, like, being a thing of, like, it was a source of pride in a sense.
Yeah, I think for me, like, it's, I'm kind of along the same line as you guys. I didn't see the movie till like a few years after, obviously, and then without my parents, I don't even know who I saw it with. I don't remember that far. But I think for me, like, just thinking about my, like, anytime I think about that movie, first of all, like, when I watched it back then, a lot of the jokes went over my head that, like, a few years after, like, later after watching it the first time, you know, you get it later and you're like, you know, as you become, you know, more grown and stuff, you're like, oh, shoot, I didn't even catch that. Yo, that's hilarious, you know? Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're, like, 13 years old or whatever it is, you know, you're not, you know, those jokes are going right over, you're flying right over your head like a rocket. You know, but when I think of the movie, I kind of think, like, it's just, anytime I think about it, I just think it's just epic. Like, seeing, I mean, especially for that day and age, like, you know, that movie's filmed 1987, 1988. Like, even now when you look at it, it's on a grand scale, you know, just from having all the animals, the elephants walking around, you know, even the wedding scene, or the initial, you know, when he's trying to get married to his first, his first bride, and that fell through. You're looking at that, even that whole scene, just the way they put the whole wedding together, the whole dance scene before that, you could tell, like, so much detail and money, and especially for a comedy, like, it was so huge, you know what I mean? Like, even now you don't see comedies to that scale, like, being epic to that scale, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You're talking about like a movie that was like an all black cast that had like a budget of almost $40 million.
Right.
That's insane. $40 million in the '80s. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I mean, that was a blockbuster type money. That's Star Wars money.
No, absolutely. And what did it gross? It grossed like over $288 million back then, which is what, like, what would that be now? Like $1 billion now?
Yeah, that's a lot.
I don't know exactly how inflation works, but saying a billion sounds like a little bit of
exaggeration. I would say like a strong 350, 400 inflation. A good solid 350.
Calvin's going to be mad disappointed someday when he goes to take his bank account thinking like, yo, what are you talking about? Compound interest. I should have $1 billion in there by now.
I put $100 last year. It should be $5 million now. What's wrong with you? All right, I'm overshooting the number a little bit, but you know what I mean. Like
just a bit. But generously. So,
I don't miss you at all. and then the other thing I look at too when I think of this movie is just, especially because I watched it again this past week, and I'm looking at like just so many stars in the movie, man. Like even people who weren't, you know, that played like little bit roles in the movie, they went on to act successful acting careers afterwards. Like,
yeah,
like I forgot that Cuba Gooding Jr. was getting his haircut. He didn't even say a word in the movie. He's just getting his haircut. This is like even before Boys in the Hood, which is crazy. Garcelle Bouvier, she's one of the pedal girls.
I think that was his first movie, right?
It might have been.
That was his first movie he ever did.
Didn't even have a speaking role. Just smiled at the, and laughed at the jokes. That was it. You had Garcelle Bouvier being one of the pedal girls.
That role terribly.
Eric LaSalle being, you know, Lisa's boyfriend. I got a story on him. I don't know if I can share it. Oh, I guess I can share it here.
The Soul Glow.
Yeah, the Soul Glow Prince. Samuel Jackson. Yeah, Robin McDowell's. Louis Anderson. Yeah.
John Amos.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just crazy. And if you look at it again, like, even somebody like Arsenio Hall, like, this guy became a legend between that movie and then jumping right into the late night talk show a few months afterwards, and he became like pretty much like the coolest talk show on TV at that point, you know what I mean, late 80s, early 90s, mm-hmm. and like it was like his time. And I can't imagine his life from jumping off of something like Coming to America and then, you know, within the span of a year, everybody wants to be on your show. Like, your show is like wildly hot. You have Michael Jackson and all these,
you have Bill Clinton on your show, insane.
Yeah,
but like that's one thing I respect about him is that, you know, he didn't rub that, hey, you know, Eddie Murphy's my best friend. He didn't. That wasn't a big thing for him. He was able to flip his own career off of that, just being in this movie alone. Yeah. And so every 5 minutes, like, hey, Eddie Murphy. Hey, you know what? Eddie Murphy has breakfast. Like, you didn't have to do that. Like, that's what you want, man, out of friends. You know, they can hustle on their own. They don't need you.
Yeah, you try to milk that for all it's worth. But no, I agree. But like I said, I mean, obviously Eddie Murphy was on fire, but he was probably like the next in line as a guy like being just hot off that movie after that.
Yeah, for sure.
That show was iconic, without a doubt.
Hey, it's Kunta Kinte! Good morning, my neighbors! Yes! Yes! Fuck you too!
I kind of want to address Eddie Murphy's genius for a second. And I know I'm kind of throwing this question at you guys, but like, can you name like a better 5 to 6 year career run than Eddie Murphy had between, say, 83 and 88? And I'll list some of the movies and things that he did between that time. Like, so you figure like since he left SNL back in, I think it was 82 or 83, whatever it is. And considering that he wrote the script for the movie, you know, his company produced it. He got John Landis to direct the movie, who at the time was like a major. He's like a legendary director. You have Niles Rogers, who did the score for the movie. Think about it. Like, between that, you couple this with the fact that between 1983 and 1988, this guy did Trading Places. He released Delirious. Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2. I'm not going to include Golden Child. That doesn't exist.
That movie's a disappointment, man. Holy shit.
Raw, you talking about Raw, and then, you know, and then he ends it off with Coming to America. I mean, like, this is probably one of the greatest comedians having like an all-time run, and to me it's kind of allowed him to get chances years later, because most people, I don't know, like, to me, I'm like, I think he still gets chances to this day to come out with movies and different things, because I think deep down, I think people have this conception of like, they think of that run. Doesn't matter how old he gets, that talent is still bubbling beneath the surface. So it's like, it doesn't matter how big Kevin Hart is and all that stuff and what he's doing. And, you know, I know he's doing all, like, he seems like he's in, like, literally in every commercial space you could think of. But, like, it's still not as big as what, or as great as what Eddie Murphy did in that 5 to 6 years. Like, those movies I just mentioned, you can pretty much put them down as, like, classic action or comedy type movies. It's, people are still trying to trace that arc and still can't do it.
Did he have, like, 3 runs, though? Because he had this first run, and after that, he did Nutty Professor, then he had a run with that, and then so that was Shrek.
I don't think you consider the Nutty Professor era a run. It was, like, Nutty Professor and Metro and Old Man.
So I'm saying, like, the fact that, you know, he was putting out, like, movies. Some of them, I don't think they did that well.
If you're just talking about just, like, prolific, like, somebody putting out a lot of movies, then it's, like, Sam Jackson is on another level there. But, like, if you're talking about, like, a run of putting out good quality movies, Eddie Murphy, that run that he's talking about, I think, was, like, pretty strong.
Yeah.
That's a lot of hits. That's a lot of hits in a short period of time.
Yeah.
So, like, he had a lot of duds back-to-back for a while in the 90s.
Yeah. he definitely had duds. But I mean, like, as far as... Because the thing is, though, even with the dud, because he was Eddie Murphy, people believed that, oh, it's just right around the corner. He's got one more movie. It's right around the corner. He's going to do something next.
Oh,
I don't think he... If you look at, like, the movies he put out and all the stuff he was working on at the time, because he still had the PJs. That was, like, 99.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was busy.
Yeah.
He never stopped working. No, like, you know, he had the super success, but, like, he never stopped working from then until, I guess, after Shrek. That was, like, the last...
No, just remember he did that. He did Norbit. Remember that we did Dream and Norbit in the same year?
Yeah.
And that was... They were saying that was the reason he didn't even get the... why he didn't win the Oscar.
Oh, for Dreamgirls. Like, yeah.
Yeah. That he deserved an Oscar for Dreamgirls. But at the time that they're, like, making the judgments for Dreamgirls, like, Norbit was in theaters, and he was just getting completely annihilated for that film.
That annoys me, though. Because, like, the Oscars is supposed to be the one movie that you did. That's your career. It doesn't matter what else you did.
Yeah, true.
You winning the Oscar for the one movie.
It's hard to hand an Oscar for, like, I could see people who are just like, I can't do this. I can't give it to Oscar to the guy who's played like Norbit. Like,
but like, that shows range, though. isn't that what you want? That shows range. Like, guy's killing it, and he's making a terrible movie at the same time. How good is this guy?
How good is this guy? This guy will just do anything. This is like a buddy back in the day who's like. He goes out 1 week and he's like going someplace with a 10, and the next week he's with some like dud. You're like, what are you doing, bro? You're all over the map, man.
You got a 10. What the hell's wrong with you? You're not even allowed to do this. It's like trying to win an Oscar and a Razzie at the same time, right? Like it's an impossible feat to do.
Well, he won the Razzie. He won the Razzie
for Norbit.
At least he got something, man.
Hell yeah, he won that. I think I looked this up. Like, he won the Razzie for Worst Actor, and didn't he win, like, wasn't it a weird thing, like, where he, because he played multiple characters, I think they also gave him a Razzie for, like, Supporting Actor, for, like, one of the other characters he played in the movie. Like, it was, like, something like that. Like, they were just, like, they really wanted to insult him. So they gave him, like, the Razzie for Worst Acting and Worst Supporting Acting. which is a real, like, kick in the pants.
Yeah, they really, they just wanted to do him dirty. That's basically it.
Oh yeah, it can be petty.
hey, so let me ask you guys: are we allowed to throw a party all the time in that 5 to 6 year career arc? Are we allowed to throw that in there too?
Because that song
actually charted. Wasn't that like number one at one point?
It got pretty high. I don't know if it was number one, but it was very high though on Billboard.
Yeah, I remember it being like a big song. Now, mind you, of course, it's not a great song, but that's just to tell you how on fire this guy was back then that he could put out something like that. And it's competing on a Billboard chart, which is crazy to me, you know?
Yeah.
Strike when the fire's hot, man.
Yeah, no, 100%. Because I'm like, when I relate it to like a musical term, it's kind of like how we see like Nas with Illmatic. Like Nas will forever get a chance because of, you know, this guy created like one of the greatest hip-hop albums of all time. And like, and you know, he's never really fallen off in terms of like his lyricism and stuff. So it's like, you know, anytime he puts out something, you're always like, okay, this might be it again. You know, you're still giving that
one something in here. Like,
I know there's something bubbling behind the surface. Yeah, you know.
The best thing with Nas, I feel like every album, there's one person who's like, this is on par with Illmatic, and you're like, stop. Like, you're wrong. Like, there's always one person who's just like, this is bad. I listened to the whole thing back to back. This is like Illmatic. You're like, no.
My issue with Nas is always the music, man. It's always the music.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the lyrics. It's always the beats.
Yeah, he's always killing the lyrics. And the content is on point, too. It's always the music. He takes the worst beat sometimes.
I know. It's
the
true.
The person we should really be judging is like, who? Like, is it Primo? Is Primo still doing his beats?
I mean, I don't know. Primo's still producing, but it's nowhere near the same level as it was like back in like, you know, in his prime. You know what I mean?
Somebody who keeps like living off of Pat Flory is like, and this is slightly sacrilegious, I think, in some circles, but Spike Lee, man, that guy is living off of some old school glory. He's put out some horrible films. And I feel like we've gone on a deep tangent from Coming to America, but like,
yeah, I know. Who are all those people?
There are some horrible Spike Lee films.
I think for people that look at Spike Lee and Eddie Murphy, it's like it's the potential there. So you're like, you know, just give it a shot. Like, it's just one more. It's right around the corner.
Finish this, like, no, just to like give you an example. Like, Spike Lee, you know, like, he did a Kickstarter a few years back.
Right.
To, like, raise money for a film, The Blood of Jesus. And so I actually sponsored that Kickstarter. And a part of, like, what you get is, like, you got a screen copy of to watch the film before it was released or something like that.
Right.
Oh my God, it was so bad.
Really?
Really?
Oh my God.
I didn't even know he did that.
It's one of the worst films I've ever seen. And I don't even know why. Like, it was, you know, I can't even, I mean, there's no need to get into it. It's absolutely horrendous. And it's like 2 hours long. But I never will get back.
So, how do you feel about
it? And it's all just based off of like, oh, but this is a guy that did Do the Right Thing. Like, obviously, he's gonna get it right one of these days. No.
Yeah.
But you still give him that shot.
How do you feel when you have like these people are like comedy icons or just like people are at the top of their game at one point, and you see them just fall off like this?
Sometimes it's like you get really early success, and it's hard to have people like tell you you're wrong. Like people, like it takes like me like early. In his career, people were like, you're a genius. And so if enough people tell you you're a genius, at some point you're just like, fuck, I am a genius. And so then, like, whatever you do, when people are, like, telling you, no, you should do it this way or this is wrong, you're like, well, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about because I'm a genius. Like, most people told me I'm a genius. Clearly I know what I'm doing, and it just doesn't work like that.
But you know, I think it's tough because, like, when you had that kind of success, and not much people have the kind of success that Eddie did, especially during that like that period that I'm talking about from 83 to 80, especially when like you're in your 20s, yo, it's really hard to try to recreate that. Like I think what happens with a lot of people is they try to, and I'm not saying specifically for him, but I'm like, I think for like a lot of people in that position, they try to recreate that, and they always end up falling flat on their face when it's like they should just take it for what it is, appreciate it. Know that it's something that you could probably can hang on a wall one day and you just move on to the other stuff because it's really hard to like to put out timeless material, man. It's almost impossible to do. You know what I mean? Like, so when you especially go through a stretch like that, like it's almost like Michael Jackson. Like, you look at Michael Jackson, you know, back then, who was just as big of a star as Eddie Murphy back then, if not bigger. And you look at his run, he had, you know, obviously the Jackson 5 stuff. You come from Off the Wall and Thriller. Like, those are like two of like the greatest albums. You know what I mean? You can argue it's two of the greatest albums you'll ever hear in music. You know, it's definitely on like a top 20 list, you know, for people of all time, for any genre of music. So when you come up with your third album now, like you come out with Bad, and I know Bad did well and Bad was huge, but like,
You can never top
Thriller. You can never top Off. Like, you listen to those albums even now, you're like this shit could go now. You know what I mean? Like, if somebody put this out now, this would be huge. Like, you can't top that. And it's funny because you look at Eddie Murphy's career now, especially when it comes to, like, you know, you hear rumblings of him, like, maybe doing stand-up one day and going back to doing that. But it's hard because after you did something where people for generations are still following your blueprint, how do you even follow that blueprint? Like, how do you follow up Raw and Delirious after you do something like that? Especially after you've made, like, hundreds of millions of dollars and, you know what I mean? You got mansions everywhere and stuff. If you're doing it, it's like, it's kind of to show that you're still funny. But, and that's the thing. Like, when you see him in certain interviews and different things, like, and I think that's probably why I think people still give him that bit of a chance. He's still funny. It's not it's not like he's fallen off as a funny person. Like, he's still an actual funny person. You know, at this stage of his career, it's like, how do you go back and even do something like stand-up? I mean, forget that 5 or 6 year run. Like, how do you even compete with Raw or Delirious? More so Delirious.
It's hard.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's really hard. But the thing, too, is that I feel like once you get to a certain level of success, everyone's basically kissing your ass. You don't have the pushback that he once had. Because, like, when Eddie Murphy was doing Raw, Delirious, whatever, he was hanging around Chris Rock and all these people, like Patrice O'Neal. Like, they're like, really funny people that they're in the circle.
Right.
So, you know, that they're, you know, give a little bit of pushback or, like, well, that joke's not that funny. Maybe you should say this. Once you do Ron Delirious, there is no pushback. Until, like, how do you tell somebody, like, nah, that's not that funny? Like, you can't. So, it's same thing with the movies and music, whatever. Like, you're just at this point where there's nobody that's on the level to tell you, nah, son, that's whack. And that's one of my beefs with the music industry, too, because, you know, when Jay was doing his run, he had Nas and Pac and, you know, like, there's a bunch of other people that he could be like, oh, man, I got to step my thing up. This is not good enough, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Eddie ever had that during his run where somebody like, oh, snap. I don't know another comedian that's, like, it's even near on the stratosphere that, oh, I got to step my thing up because this guy's coming for me.
Yeah.
I feel like if anybody was going to tell him that you this is whack and you're wrong on this, is like Charlie Murphy. Like, so why did, wonder why Charlie Murphy never, like, I'd love to hear their conversations because I feel like Charlie Murphy's brother would have been like, oh, this is whack. What are you doing?
You can't put out Golden Child. He's like, nah,
was he in the army then? I can't remember. There's a point when Charlie Murphy was like, he was still in the army and then he started being in the Entourage and driving people around and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if that was around that.
Your theory is Charlie Murphy wasn't around for a certain period of time when, like, some questionable decisions were made.
Yeah.
According to, Charlie Murphy's Real Hollywood Stories, even he made questionable decisions.
That's also true. Hang out with Regine, so, you know, it's a tough run.
but it's for real, like, what you guys are talking about is true because, like, how do you tell somebody who's that on fire, like, during that run? How do you tell somebody who's that on fire no? Or tell somebody who's that on fire, like, don't pick up that script or don't write that. That sucks. Like, how do you tell somebody that to that extent? Like, you know what I mean? Like, when you're on that kind of a run, when you're on fire like that, how do you tell anybody in any genre no?
Everybody's different, man. Everybody's different, right? So, like, there may very well be somebody who told Eddie Murphy, don't do this movie, you're wrong on this. And that person just fucking disappeared. But, like, the people, you know, you hear about everybody else or all the other people that kept working with him because they're just like, man, I'm getting paid. I'm not rocking the boat. You were just riding the Eddie Murphy train, man. I mean,
get that champagne, man. You're in the VIP room right now.
Yeah, you're like, hey, let's get with this, like, movie. This movie is $30-40 million budget and making $300 million, like, let's get on that train.
Yeah.
Or in Calvin's world, making a $1 billion. Like,
I'm so gonna edit you out of this podcast. I remember Arsenio telling the story about how when he was writing for Coming to America. And he was talking about, like, yo, telling Arsenio, like, the story, what he wants to do. And he's like, yeah, and I'm going to play all these different characters. And, you know, I'm going to play, like, an old Jewish man. I'm going to play the black barber. I'm going to play this. I'm going to play that. I'm going to play all these different people. And Arsenio was like, yo, we have so many different black comics out here, like Keaton Ivory Wayans and Robert Towns and all these people doing their thing. He's like, yo, you need to call these people, like, you know, get them some of these roles. And then he was like, yeah. And then you can play a couple of characters too. And he's like, yeah, fuck this singing. Yeah, you do your thing. I'm going to support you any way that you can, you know. And that was like the end of that. That's so that's what I'm saying. Like, no way somebody's, you know, jumping in that, throwing their body on that train track and being like, nah.
Yeah.
collecting all those extra checks, man. Shit. No joke.
I think that was the most genius part of the movie is them doing all the roles.
Oh, yeah.
Especially Randy Watson. Yeah. Oh, my his best character. Like, I absolutely the love that. Point. That's like, that's my scene, man.
Yo,
I
bought a Randy Watson t-shirt this past winter, actually.
Right, yeah. the singing is like, it's phenomenal. That scene is absolutely phenomenal. And Arsenio Hall.
Oh, he killed
that scene too. I mean, like, this the combination was absolutely brilliant. And then them playing themselves in the audience, like Clarence. Oh man, loved it.
Because like, how long did it take to do that scene? Because you had to be a couple days apart or whatever.
Oh, at least, yeah. You got
to. Yeah,
because Arsenio and Eddie Murphy are like three different characters all in the same scene together. I mean, they're not interacting with each other, and well, I guess slightly they are. But yeah, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant scene.
I want you to put your hands together and welcome him to the stage. Big round of applause for Jackson Heights' own Mr. Randy Watson. Yes, Randy Watson.
That boy is good.
Mm-hmm. Good and terrible.
To me, he steals the show with his range of talent, talking about Eddie Murphy. Well, the both of them, really, because to me, nothing's more evident of that than the barbershop scene, the first one between the old Jewish man, the obnoxious barber, and Akeem. You know, like, to play all three of those roles is completely different from one and the other. Different accents, different personalities. You know, we joked about him getting Razzies and stuff, but it's like, how did he not win an award for doing something like that? Like, that's ridiculous. You know?
That's some hating ass shit right there. That's what that was.
No.
If you talk about rage, are you kidding me? Like, how did this movie not get nominated for anything? That's wild.
I know. For real, though.
Is that a real question?
Oh, yeah. It's rhetorical, man. Don't worry. It's rhetorical. I know the answer. I'm just saying.
Making funky music is a must. I'm number one.
I'm gonna jump into like the black cultural relevance of this movie just for a little bit. So you guys stay with me with this. But, like, you know, just doing my little deep dive here and seeing that this is the 30-year anniversary of the movie, you know, I jumped into, like, some of this information and what it meant for the culture, say, back then. And I'm just looking at 1988 for black culture as a whole. And it was just, 88 is probably, like, it's a forgotten year. But when you look back on it, man, it's an incredible year for, like, black pop culture. Now, obviously, I'm too young to remember all the details that was happening back then. But, you know, doing like just a little research, there's a lot of similar parallels between 1988 and all the stuff that's happening in 2018. So for like, so just to lay it out here, just, and like I said, again, stay with me with this. So in 88, you had the first wave of great music coming from hip hop. You know, some people, you know, you can call it like the golden era or the golden year of hip hop. And I'm sure if I read out some of these names, Mambo, I mean, Keo, you'll be very familiar with it. For example, The Great Adventures of Slick Rick. You got the Boogie Down Productions by Any Means Necessary album. EPMD, Strictly Business, NWA, Straight Outta Compton came out. Public Enemies takes a million to hold us back, that album. Big Daddy Kane, like there was so much albums that was going on during that time. It was crazy. You also came off a legendary hip hop beef between MC Shan and KRS-One that people are going to remember forever. You had the number one show on TV that was a black TV show and the Cosby Show that was doing things no black show was doing before. And they had a spinoff called A Different World that ended up being iconic in its own right. But, you know, during that time, it was kind of in its like infancy, beginning stages. You had R&B, which is dead right now, but R&B back then was on fire. You had, you know, people like New Edition, Bobby Brown, Keith Sweat, Janet Jackson, I'll Be Sure, dropping all kinds of albums. Guy released their first album, which is a classic. Teddy Riley changed the whole landscape of music or the sound of music. Think about this. In a span of 10 days, I do my research finding this out. In a span of 10 days, you had New Edition release the Heartbreak album, right? And Bobby Brown released Don't Be Cruel in the same day, right? Later in the week, Big Daddy Kane releases Long Live the Kane. And then at the end of the 10 days, you had this movie come out.
That's crazy.
That is insane. Like, just that alone. Like, just forget the year. Just that month alone, you're like, Jesus Christ. You know what I mean? Like, that's insane. You know what I'm saying? And then I think earlier in the month, you had Guy release their album. It's just insane. Michael Jordan was like, he won his first MVP, won every individual award. And then on top of that, the popularity of the Jordans really jumped off when he released the threes, you know? And then lastly, you have one of the biggest movies, you know, of the year, have an African storyline. It helped become iconic from a black culture perspective. It pushed along, you know, like generations forward, everybody, you know, followed that movie, and it affected everything from the slang to the fashion. Now, if you compare it to this year, mind you, it's still early, so, you know, we got to see how things shake out in the future. Right now, we're going through a solid wave of black music right now, in my opinion, from the Black Panther soundtrack, you know, the stuff Kendrick's doing and what TDE's doing. You know, that J-Rock album is supposed to be like a real banger. You got Royce the 5'9 dropping something really like, he dropped a banger as well. The whole wave of music that's coming from good music right now, J. Cole, Beyonce, and Jay-Z just dropped. You know, depending on how you feel about Migos albums, I don't know. But that's another one that, you know, like obviously people are going crazy over. Drake's dropping an album the day that this podcast is going to be released. We had a hip hop beef between Pusha T and Drake that I'm pretty sure people are going to remember forever going forward. The number one black TV show that's doing things with the black family that hasn't been seen before in Blackish started a spinoff show called Grownish that's doing well. And the quality of that show is really good, even though it's also in its infancy stages. There's no equivalent to like basketball, what Jordan did in 88, but there's a new wave of ball players that are coming in that you can see the future is going to be ridiculous. And then same thing. Lastly, you have the biggest movie that affected pop culture, black culture, is based from an African storyline that made an immediate impact, and is trending to push the generation forward. And it started to already affect certain cultural things from memes and GIFs. You know, like some African prints and different things are coming back. So it's funny to see like the parallels between the two. Like it's weird, but it's like it's 2018 is kind of shaping out to, at least it could shape out to be the same way. But like 1988 as a whole, looking at the cultural relevance of what Coming to America did, and mind you, it's a comedy, but like that came in the wave of like, you know, people being proud of, you know, I'm black and I'm proud and Public Enemy and everybody's having the medallions and all that stuff. Like, guys, you know, I'm old enough to remember that era and how crazy, like everything kind of like cultivated into one, like just one movement at one point in time, late 80s, early 90s. Like, it was crazy.
That's what I'm hoping for this to happen. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's still early, but it's similar parallels. I'm not saying like that's what's going to happen, but it's like similar parallels how it's shaken out so far. So
well, you know, it's interesting though, with Kanye, what he's doing with good music and trying to do a new thing with the EP and, you know, doing collabo projects. Like, he could invigorate hip hop and people trying to do something different at least.
Yeah.
Like, it's a good possibility based on how this stuff is doing right now. And it's doing pretty good, actually.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's, you know, everybody's, you know, always looking at their Spotify app and different things on their iTunes just to see what new albums coming out and different things. But like, the culture's being affected, you know what I mean? And like how Black Panther this year is kind of affecting the magical place of Wakanda, you know, and stuff. And, you know, back in 88, it was Zamunda, but like, everything's being kind of, it's all intertwining together, you know what I mean? So, so it's crazy to see. Yeah. And now we're living in that woke era, you know, where people now are people wearing their natural hair and African print is starting to come back again. And like, it's crazy to see like how it's all kind of intertwining, you know what I mean? From the movies to the music and everything else. So it's interesting comparing the 2 years back and forth.
I definitely want to see more of this. Like, I want to see people trying to be more creative, and Black Panther can get more people to be directors and, you know, people trying to, because like, it was a big thing that when they did the soundtrack, they were connected to the movie with the music, and it used to launch a lot of people's careers and that kind of stuff. And I want the music and movie and culture to be together again, like it used to be.
Yeah.
I have no connection to a lot of the music going on right now. Like, it's just, I can't feel it. I guess we're too old for it. I don't know.
You sound like you're too old for it.
I mean, I got all
like,
for
that,
it.
That's just the nature of it, man. Like, you get older, like, you get a bit of distance from, like, day-to-day, of course you don't move with it. I mean, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, if you're, you know, it's the natural way that things happen. And then, like, you connect with certain artists and certain at times, but in general, like, we are so, like, steeped in the culture of that era that we kind of came of age in that it's hard to, like, appreciate a different generation's take on that style of music or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, true.
It's about our parents, you know. People much older than us, like of our parents' generation's reaction to hip hop was not exactly the most understanding a positive thing.
That's true.
I mean, in general, society's not understanding of hip hop at the time was like, this is the trashiest of trash music. So it became cool.
But what about like creatively in terms of like the art and just the innovation of like different creative projects and stuff that's happening, like kind of similar to what happened like in 88. Like, what do you feel about that?
I mean, creativity is what it is, right? Like, people are always going to be striving and trying to change the culture and change like the way that things are done. And it's a beautiful thing, man. I mean, it's going to move with the times. The times are always, you know, moving forward, and people push creative boundaries and they find, whether it's like a different delivery system for music, or it's a different style of music, or it's a different, you know, all these different ways that culture is consumed, it changes. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And it's like, and even if I don't move with it at all times, like I can still appreciate it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have a massive appreciation for like what people are trying to do with the music and the SoundCloud generation and all these things. I love it. I don't necessarily, I'm not like going out and copping all the albums and following people on like Instagram and Twitter and like following on Snapchat and up with their daily lives and all that. Like, I'm not in that, but at the same time, I think I can still appreciate what they're trying to do. It's not hard to distinguish yourself creatively from kind of like stand out in an industry.
Yeah.
Like, it's like when we're trying to do stuff, and like when you're in a creative industry and you're trying to stand out, like it's not not easy. You're always trying to do it. And I appreciate any time like the younger generation does that in any way, shape or form.
Mm. Yeah, but when I started producing, like the way people were looking for music was you couldn't do what everybody else was doing. Like that was, you know, if you had a beat like Swizz or whatever, they would laugh you out of the office. And then just slowly I just watched it turn into, well, I want this exact same thing. I don't want any creativity. I don't want you to do your own spin on it. I want this exact same thing. And that's the thing that drove me crazy, especially like for, like if you look at comedy, look at movies, like it's just a copy of whatever worked. And so everyone's just trying to copy the thing. So like I love the creativity, especially like, even like you, even don't like Kanye, I like the fact that he's like, you know what, screw it. We're going to go to Montana, I'll make a bunch of albums, and, you know, we're just going to do our own thing. Because if you look at, like, Coming to America, that was something that I don't think anybody thought it was possible. And took Eddie Murphy being like, you know what, I'll produce it myself. I'll write it myself. But I don't think anyone's sending in scripts like that. Right. It took the fact that he's like, you know, I'm just doing it myself.
Yeah.
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 I think we need more of that, I don't know, ingenuity or something. Like, just somebody that's willing to take it on their own shoulders and do it.
That being said, that same kind of like, let's go, I'm just going to make this thing, even though nobody's bringing me the script and I'm seeing it. It brings you Coming to America, but it also brings you, I got the hookup. So, like,
that's fair.
You know, you take the good and the bad. You know what I mean? Like, you get a lot of, like.
How dare you talk about that movie in Belly? How dare you talk about those movies, Mambo?
I can't wait. I can't wait until your anniversary pod of I Got the Hookup, because then we can get into it. All the genius that is Master P.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to do that, and it's going to get deleted by mistake. You know, I'm pretty sure. I can guarantee you that's probably going to happen. And it's going to be like an 8-minute pod.
And this movie stands out, man, in a way that Coming to America is a movie that just is unique in the way that it stands out from all these other films. Like, we forget that there were other films that were being made by all black casts, you know, like,
yeah,
maybe they didn't have the same budget or the same quality actors, but like these things were happening. It's not like they weren't happening, but this just, like, when you add that quality cast to it, and the quality of the writing and the directing and all those elements, and put some real thought into it, yeah, it's just beautiful what they made. It has its flaws. It has major flaws, like a lot of movies. You know, they don't always stand the test of time. But for the time that when it was made, I mean, I think it's, you know,
I think Coming to America still holds up.
Yeah, I believe
as far as the jokes and stuff.
I think that, like, I think that there's definitely, like, it definitely does hold up. It doesn't, like, I'm trying to think of, like, anything specific that, like, stands out, but it is a bit of a ridiculous portrayal of
Africa. Oh no, like,
it's like, beyond ridiculous. Like, there was like the reality of, like, the way that they were living was a real thing, and it's like, I think the closest was probably somebody like Mobutu Sese Seko, who, of course, was, like, super oppressive, stole all the money from the country, you know, to, like, live a lavish lifestyle that he wasted on himself and his family. And so it's, like, ultimately quite a tragic story. And, like, if you were to really think about this film, it is quite tragic. Like, no, you're basically talking about, like, a small African nation that, I don't know, whatever its wealth comes from, is run by this, like, royal family, and the son is, like, just wasting money going and living this lavish lifestyle when he, you know, he gives away money all the time, and when he has all his possessions stolen, it's not a big deal. Like, he'll just get more. Money wasn't a real thing to them. And when you think about it, like, I mean, and again, I'm intellectualizing something that does not need to be intellectualized because it's a stupid comedy from 1988. But, like, when you really think about it, it's quite tragic. Like, later on in life, like, I thought about it, and I was like, oh wow, they're, like, basically dictators that rob the country blind. But it's still a really funny movie.
You know, it's gonna lead to my next question, but the other thing I just wanted to add is, I'm like, this generation who, you know, watching this movie now, they're never gonna understand the cultural significance of the Jerry Curl. They're just never gonna get it. They're never gonna understand it.
I live in California, and that is a whole other level. It was just ridiculous. I came from when I lived in St. Louis, and everyone's still doing, you know, fades and stuff like that. So I went to the barber shop, and I was like, "Yo, I want to fade." Everybody, including the barber, had a Jerry Curl, and they were looking at me crazy, like, "What are you doing here?" Like, it's one of those things. They're like, nobody had a fade. Nobody had, you know, just the Caesar, no ball cut, nothing. Everyone's just like, it was Jerry Curl, right? Everybody had Jerry Curl. How does the whole state have a Jerry Curl?
That's ridiculous. And on top of that, like, you're lucky nobody didn't tie you down and put your head in a bucket of, like, activator.
I was like, oh, hell no. That's never happening. Never.
Man, it did make a good statement about the Jerry Curl, man, like, as a film, like.
Yeah.
It was, you know. that was absolutely a thing, right? And here's this guy coming in and being like, you know, let's make fun of it.
They made a whole song out of it, man. They made a whole song out of it.
yeah, exactly.
Now let's see if you can defend yourself, you sweat from a baboon's balls. Freeze, you diseased rhinoceros pizzle.
You know, it's something I wanted to ask. The question's for both of you, but I guess it's more for you, Mambo, being that you're of African descent. On a scale of Black Panther to Mark for Death, how would you rate the authentic accents of this movie?
Okay, so obviously, if I'm understanding the scale correctly, it's like Black Panther, laughable accent, Mark for Death, spot on accent.
Whatever.
Is that what I'm understanding? You know, I'm sure that I've got the scale correct. Like,
not quite.
No, the accents are garbage. The accents, I mean, maybe the Queen's accent is good, but like the African accents are trash. I mean, they're no. Like,
I don't think they were trying at that point.
I don't think they were really making an effort. Like, you can't even get mad at it because I don't think they were trying at all.
Yeah, like you can see, like, you know, with Black Panther and Chadwick Boseman, is like, you know, he went into like, Ryan Coogler went into different places trying to learn, you know, some of the dialects and different things. Yeah, you can absolutely tell none of that went through. That wasn't even a concept thought for this movie. Like, some of the quotes in the movie, like, you know, sweat from a baboon's balls and you hippopotamus shit. Like, you're like, what African even talks like that? I've never met anybody talk like that ever in my life.
No, not a thing. You know, there were a lot of things in the African element of that film that has, like, had nothing to do with any reality of Africa. There were very few things in that film that had anything to do with reality, my friend. And the accents are definitely one of those.
Yeah, I look at it and it just reminds me of, like, the similarities between, like, you know how anytime anybody in the movies goes to the Caribbean and everybody sounds Jamaican, doesn't matter if they go to Turks and Caicos, Trinidad, doesn't matter where they go, everybody sounds Jamaican. Yeah, man, everything's cool, man. Everything's Irie.
They throw an Irie in there.
Everything's Irie. Like, everything. They all sound the same. You're like, isn't he from Barbados? Like, why does he sound like that? You know? All the movies are the same thing, and I guess it's the same for, like, African movies. Like, they sounded more British than anything else, you know.
Yeah.
If that's the case, you know what I mean. So it's like it's just funny to see. Like, there was, but you look at the times, like, especially like movies like Mark for Death. I always go to Mark for Death for this because that's probably like the worst. But like Mark for Death was like it's like terrible. So you know what I mean? But it's like you know that's like the worst scale. But it's like you know what? Harvard's still around that scale. Like. It's almost like they weren't thinking past America back in those days at all.
No, there's one lower. Estelle's got a groove. That's the one lower for me.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
That's the bottom.
That's pretty low.
No, for sure. Even though I'm hearing now, I haven't watched it yet, but even though I'm hearing now that, like with Luke Cage 2 and some of the
Jamaican
accents.
Oh, I was just about to bring that up.
I didn't see it yet.
Stop watching. I couldn't take it.
Is that bad, man? Oh my!
It's bad. And the thing is, though, like there's a couple Jamaican guys in there, but they're trying to speak proper English so people can understand them. So it just makes it worse. So it turns into a parody.
Oh man! See,
bad.
I'm still gonna watch it, but when I'm seeing it online, I'm already like the comments online. I'm already like, oh God, no.
I'm trying, man. It's a tough watch, man. It's a tough vlog.
But the thing is, it's like, yo, like you're in New York. Just can't you hire like a Jamaican consultant and just have them be like, no. You can't say that. Don't do that. Nobody believes that. Like,
yeah.
like you can hire, like, just go to Brooklyn, just hire some, just get somebody from Flatbush and just hire them as a consultant for like 3 months. I don't understand like how people still butcher that shit like in this day and age.
It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't.
Somebody made a calculation and just said like, all right, how many people are going to be pissed versus, you know, the number of people who aren't going to know. And then just like, nobody's going to know. Like, so few people are going to know.
I guess.
but my
thing is, like, it's somebody's crunching numbers and being like, nobody gives a crap. Nobody gives a crap. Like, which is a terrible thing. Like, right? Like, you should always strive for authenticity. But like, if you think about it, man, it's because you have some people in charge who don't give a shit, and they go, nobody else is going to care either. So what does it matter? Like, it just needs to be remotely close or whatever. Or whatever comical version of the accent that people just expect to hear anyways. But then if you have, like, people of West... Like, if you have, like, actual West Indians, people, Caribbean people who are in the production, like, and in charge, they will care. And they will be like, no, you can't do this. Make the man learn how to do a real accent. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's the same way a lot of times you need a person of color in a room sometimes in order for people to understand that, like, what you are trying to do in this production is not okay because of A, B, and C. And you can tell sometimes when you're like, there was nobody of color in the room when the decision was made to make that thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Absolutely. In this instance, I would probably guess that there wasn't a single person of, like, West Indian descent in the room when they were deciding whether or not, like, any question about the accent.
But you know what though? Like, even if you're not gonna hire, you know, take my idea and hire a consultant, like, can't you just YouTube like a conversation with like Sean Paul or Beanie Man and be like,
you're talking about an industry that hires like people. They'll hire African Americans to play Somali people. Like, is going to care whether this person's accent is like 100% or if this person's accent is 25%. They hire African Americans to play Somalis, bro.
I know.
That is some wild shit. Like, people do not look anything alike. Like, Somalis are very distinct looking people. They have that one Somali guy that they hired for Captain Phillips, and that was it. Like, what?
Everybody else. No, you're right. It's almost like having the foresight to hire a Trinidadian guy to play an African king in Black Panther, but that's a whole other topic. You know,
like, what was that?
Wow, bullshit.
What is that?
It was like mad with Indians in Black Panther. I'm still pissed about that.
Run this bitch, that's why.
Yo, y'all act like there's no African actors in America. Please.
No, that was wrong, though. That was just wrong. How do you not find somebody?
And to bring it back full circle, it's been happening since fucking Coming to America.
True.
That's fair. That's true. Totally fair.
Very, very fair to say that. So, you know, I'll move on to the next question. I'll start with you, Kia. What was your favorite scenes? Like, what are some of your favorite scenes from the movie?
I think my favorite thing was the opening scene when he does the whole waking up. He's got the whole, you know, orchestra and they're playing music for him to wake up. Like, I think it just set the tone perfect for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And like the table scene where his father's all the way down, he's basically down the street talking to him. And they're like, oh, he's coming closer. Like, what's happening like, right now? Like, get the roles settled. Like, that whole thing cracked me up. I love the bar thing too. When they went in the bar looking for girls.
Oh yeah, that's and right.
The girls would start beatboxing like that.
that was pretty good.
And don't lie, you like the robot scene. Let's not. You know you love that scene. You should have probably.
I'm not mad at that.
You probably should.
I'm not mad at any of that. All right, that's all perfect for me. I'm not mad at anything.
Mambo's like, absolutely. Yeah. What about you, Bob? What's some of your favorite scenes from the movie?
I think, like, when I mentioned it earlier, man, my favorite scene has got to be Randy Watson's scene. I mean, I think that, like, just the whole idea of the, like, Black community rally that's happening, there was just, there's so much in that scene, built into that scene, from, you know, McDowell's being the center of the community somehow, but definitely Randy Watson getting on stage. Jackson Heights' own Randy Watson gets on stage. He takes the cake. And just like the commentary, like the classic line of, that boy good. That boy good. Get basically every time I watch it, man. Like, that entire scene just does it for me.
Yeah, I think for me, there's a few, of course. I mean, you can't narrow down to just one, obviously. But, like, obviously, Ona singing She's a Queen to Be, that's obviously, like, right up there with like, any classic moment. Yep. Honestly,
all the barbershop scenes.
Yeah,
I forgot about the barbershop. Yeah,
I think my favorite part is when Hakeem comes back in the barbershop and they're like, who's that? He's like, oh, hey, it's Kuta Kinte, and then everybody else start laughing. Like, every time I see that part, it kills me. The part where Daryl, you know, when he takes Lisa out, and I think Hakeem and him are outside, you know, taking out the garbage, and he's like, hey, take this milkshake, hold it for me, and he just tosses it on Akeem, and it explodes all over his face and his chest. Like, yeah, there's so many parts, man. And yeah, Randy Watson, obviously, like I said, I own a t-shirt that I have of him, so obviously that's one of my favorites too. And then underratedly, the basketball game, man, when Akeem gets jerked by Patrice in the movie, you know,
I forgot about that.
Like, that part, that part's like, that's classic, man. That's, you know, that's hilarious right there.
Well, and the best part is when he goes to the restroom and he comes back and the two guys that recognize him.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Take a picture of him. And then you see him just like, who were those guys? He's just like, some guy I met in the restroom.
It just keeps it moving.
Is great.
While we take a quick intermission from this podcast, throughout the life of these podcasts that I've done so far on Sal Sharaf Radio, I've been pointing out the fact that this man's team, otherwise known as Marist College, was featured in the basketball game that Akeem, Lisa, Daryl, and Patrice went to go watch in Coming to America. So now real quick, I just want to find out about the inner workings of how this came about. So Big Brother Curtis, explain how your team got on such an iconic movie and how come you didn't win an Oscar. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that Coming to America story, it's not as elaborate or as sexy as it is. By far, it really wasn't. What actually happened, I like to call it like a rabbit's tail story, meaning that we got lucky. So that particular year, we had the opportunity to play St. John's in the Gardens. So we played St. John's, normal game, whatever. Season concluded, and the director or producer, whoever, called the athletic director and said they were doing they were making a movie with Eddie Murphy. And there was a scene where they were going to the Gardens to watch a game, and they wanted our permission to use that particular footage to watch, to put on the movie. So we gave, basically Marist College gave them permission to use the video, along with St. John's, gave them permission to use the video, and that's how we came on Coming to America. And so that was it, in a nutshell. I'd like to give a different story and say, yeah, there Eddie Murphy was in the house, and we met him, and we shook his hand. None of that. It was just a luck of the draw.
So you didn't meet Lisa?
I did not meet Lisa.
You didn't meet Patrice? Patrice didn't want to take you out after the game?
No. Did not meet Patrice. Did not. None of that.
Did you see Eric LaSalle's Jerry Curl shining in the flesh? Nothing?
No, but back then there was a lot of Jerry juice dripping all over the seats anyhow. So, but no, I definitely didn't meet him either. So that's my Coming to America story. And you can see me at the end of the bench. Not because I was a bench warmer, but because I was hurt. I had a broken foot.
God, this is a useless story.
Sorry.
Hippopotamus shit. So I have a couple more questions here before I wrap up. But so I'll ask you guys this. Now, obviously, you're hearing rumblings about how this movie's, like, they're looking to try to remake this movie. Obviously, I don't know if it's going to be with the same cast. So I'm just going to come straight on and ask you guys, should this movie be remade in 2018 or beyond? I'll start with you. Actually, I'll start with you, Keo.
No, make new shit. We need new stuff. So I'm tired of the remakes. Stop it there. How do you make this better? You can't.
I agree.
I mean, I would say, like, I agree. I don't think there's a point in making a remake of it. Like, I don't think there's any point in doing that. Just make new stuff. Like, it's not that hard. Like, there's just no point in doing a remake. But from what I understand, it's not a remake. It was meant to be a sequel. Like, it's like a follow-up film. And that, I'd be on board with.
Especially
if you can bring as much of the original cast back into it as you could. It was like, specifically if you can get Eddie and Arsenio on board, which I'm pretty sure they would be considering where their current careers stand. But like, I think that if you do a sequel, I think it's something that if it's done right with the right writers and the right cast, it could be fun, entertaining, and take you kind of back to a place that, I don't know, so magical. I think that there's a way to do it. But I would definitely say, a remake is that's just lazy, and you're just like trying to build off fame of something that was done, you know, 30 years ago. Versus, you know, if you do a follow up film, you know, you're trying to like, it could also be a complete disaster. A sequel has potential, whereas I think a remake doesn't really.
Yeah, but that's my fear, is that if you try and do a remake or a sequel, you know, like the comedy, the people who created it, like their comedy chops are rusty or whatever, and it just doesn't have the same shine as it had before. So it kind of, do you think it would tarnish the original being connected to it, or it'd be separate still?
No, it'd be so separate, man. It's 30 years. That's a big difference. I don't think you can tarnish the original. How bad would a sequel have to be in order to tarnish the original? That's like, good God, man.
We're talking about the guy who made Norbit, man. It's possible.
I'm just saying. That would have to be so bad where you're just like, looking back on it, I hate coming to America. This is like, you hate somebody, you know, I don't know. I don't think it could tarnish like that.
You know, it's funny, as you brought this up, I'm like, you're talking about bringing back the old cast. In my head, I don't know, I kind of picture like Arsenio still refreshing like his Twitter feed, hoping that the Coming to America, is they greenlit the project so that he can jump right on board. Like, I feel like every day he's just refreshing his thing. Is the Coming to America back up? Nope.
Nope.
Okay. I'll get out of bed, you know, like... and you know, and speaking of remakes, yeah, I'm one of those guys that, like, you can remake something and I don't really have an issue with it, but if it's a classic or it's iconic status, I kind of rather you leave it alone. Like, for example, and I'm gonna go off scale for a second, did any of you guys see this trailer for freaking Magnum PI? The new Magnum PI?
No.
Oh my
God. What? Why?
Oh, oh God, it pisses me off when I watch it. Just YouTube it. I can't believe they would touch Magnum PI like that. It bothers the hell out of me.
Television shows do that all the time.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Is the laziest.
I know.
Space, right?
I know.
Like, so television, like, there's a bunch of executives who are like, they don't come up with original ideas. Original ideas are really hard to come by. But filmmakers are like, it's a different place. Like, I think that, like, in film, more originality should exist.
Right.
Sequels is another case because, you know, like, it's a business. But remake, it's not as bad in film as it is in television. Television is notorious for remake. I feel like there's literally a department at, like, ABC, NBC, and CBS. Like, a department that is just tasked with, like, watching old shows and figuring out how they can remake them. Like, that's all they do.
Yeah,
and then
I agree.
Like Roseanne, even when they reboot something, they're just like, even when she gets all racist and shit, they cancel it, and then they're like, let's just still make another one, but just without Roseanne. Fuck out of here.
But you know what's funny? It's like to me, just to, I guess, to answer my own question, I don't think this should make part two, obviously. Like, because I mean, for example, well, they're gonna be wearing tighter jeans now than they did in '88. I'm sure Tekashi 6ix9ine will be Hakeem's favorite artist now. You know what I mean? So just I'm just not with it, man. I just like I said, to me, I'm just like, yo, don't touch the original. Once it's a class, I don't care what it is. It could be a TV show, a song, just anything that is a classic or it's iconic. Leave it alone. It reminds me of like
don't know if you heard that earlier this year with Taylor Swift. Remember when Taylor Swift? I don't know if you guys heard about that. She did the remake. She remade Earth, Wind, and Fire September with acoustics.
I don't keep up on Taylor Swift like you do, bro.
What's that?
What?
I don't keep up on Taylor Swift like
no,
you
but,
do, bro.
No, but no. But stop it. But I came across is that she redid Earth, Wind, and Fire September with acoustics.
Sure.
With acoustics.
You just came across it.
With a guitar. Charlamagne the God was talking about it. That's why I fell into it. But I'm like, it was hilarious because I'm like, yo, the way she did it, by the time it was done, it's almost one of those country folk songs you sing in front of the fireplace. You know what I mean? Like, by the time she was done, it's like you just wanted to take her guitar and just throw it in the fireplace. Yo, just leave it alone, man. Like, that song is great. Earth, Wind, and Fire, September. It's a great song. Beautiful song. It's a happy song. Leave it alone. You know? If I want to hear it again, I'll go on Spotify and just find Earth, Wind, and Fire and play it again. Like, don't come out with your version of it. It's okay. You know?
Tell her why you mad, son. Tell her why you mad.
Someone's got to be like, nah, don't do that. Like, it's like an app or something. Just jump out. Like, no.
Stop. I know, for real. Yo, but there's somebody Taylor, out there. That's a great Taylor idea, Swift. Taylor. Put it out.
Yo, Taylor Swift is going to be so vexed when she listens to this podcast, bro.
Like, I thought they were talking about coming to America. Like, why are they forcing me for? Like,
she's like, how did I come up with this? Ah,
she's so bad. She's like, lose me as a fan, and I'm like, thank you, Lord.
She's like, Calvin, you are now fired from my fan group, president of my fan group.
And I'm doing the Tiger Woods fist pump, like, mm-hmm. Thank you, Jesus. But it's funny when you look at this movie, like. I forget even doing the remake. Like, if this movie was to be remade, that's what they're talking or what have you. Like, would this premise even be believable in 2018? Like, a prince leaving Zamunda for 40 days to soil his wild oats. You can't even try to leave with that concept in this day and age now. Like, wouldn't the Me Too movement just crush this and people's careers? Like, having Hakeem fly to Queens just to basically, because he wants to bone everything moving? Like, that would even work.
People will be salty about it.
Oh my God!
I don't know, man. There's a lot of weird movies out there these days, man. Anything goes. I don't know.
Depends on who's making it, though. It definitely depends on who's making the movie.
And then
they're remaking Superfly for fuck's sake.
I know.
I mean, who knows?
It's true. And then I think too with a concept of them going to like the hood and trying to live this meager life, and I'm like, yeah, even if you're not staying at the Waldorf, I mean you could probably stay at the Ramada or like the Best Western or something. You don't have to take it to that varying degrees.
That cab driver did him wrong. Like, it's all stuck to the cab driver.
That's true.
That guy was a prick, bro. That guy was like, oh, you want to go to the people? I got you. Like,
true.
Geez, ball.
He could have took him to like the Hyatt. You're absolutely right. The Brooklyn Marriott. He could have took him there. Something. You didn't have to take him to the hood in Queens, where they're reselling him back his jewelry like 10 minutes later.
Exactly. You know that cab driver got a cut of that. Cab driver still had his shit. Cab driver's worse.
And then plus the storyline, I think there's a pretty good chance that it gets, you know, like Hakeem doesn't get Lisa and it gets squashed down, because think about it. Don't you think he would have probably taken down Patrice after that St. John's game?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then if he tries to shoot a shot with Lisa, Patrice is going to get mad. Lisa's going to be disgusted. Then he's going to end up with like an Instagram model and just take her back to Africa. And then that's the end of it. You know,
really played this out in your mind.
Like, the script just falls apart.
The whole thing would be he'd be looking through Instagram to find his queen. That's
true
works.
Too. Yeah. He wouldn't even leave. He wouldn't even leave. I'd just go on Tinder.
I think you're just. He just go on Tinder.
He's
like, extra to go to New York.
He's like, yo, it's 1 million follows? I'm just going to fly her up. There's the end of the movie. There you go. There's the end of the movie.
There you go.
I came to America to find my bride. I came to Queens to find you.
What are your final thoughts on the movie? I guess I'll start with you, Mambo.
Such a wide open question. I mean, I think what, like, my final thoughts are, this movie, it represented something positive at a time, you know, in that time period. It kind of, like, it meant something to a number of people. it was a kind of a positive portrayal of seeing like black Africans in like a positive light at a time when that really wasn't a thing. And I think to see an all black cast, you know, together at that time, creating something that was so amazing and hilarious and funny, and something we're still talking about 30 years later, is a beautiful thing. And I think the legacy of it is just that it's a shame that there isn't more films in that kind of space. You know what I mean? Like there aren't more of that type of thing. Not necessarily like everything needs to be just like that, but you know, it's like a unique thing. Like it stands up, and we look at it, and we're like, oh yes, 30 years later, like that was an iconic film. And I wish that it was just something we could say, like, oh, that was just a good film. Like that was a good film in a sea of many, you know, good films like it. And I think 30 years later, we're getting to a space where we're seeing more and more films with all black casts, or just like more diverse casts, and they're of a certain quality. And I think that's a great thing and a wonderful thing. And yeah, I think that I hope they don't do a remake of it, because I think it's stands the time to this day. But I'd be real happy to see a sequel, man. I wouldn't mind seeing that barbershop again.
Yeah, no question. And what about you, Kia? What's your final thoughts before we go?
I think it's amazing that, you know, 30 years ago, they're able to produce a movie that still holds up, you know, as far as comedy, because, like, you know, most movies now, their comedy's dated, where it's based on talking topical stuff. And I mentioned Tinder, Uber, whatever. You know, 10 years from now, there's probably not going to be Uber. It's going to be called something else. So
right. None
of that stuff makes any sense. But, like, you know, for the most part, at least from the plot perspective and even, you know, the ideas and themes in the movie, for the most part, they still hold up. I get to your point about how they have to change a lot of stuff for a sequel, but, like, you know, it's still an interesting, fun movie to watch. And, like, I wish there was more of that out today rather than, you know, I'm tired of the slave movies and, you know, the drug dealer like Superfly. Like, I don't want any of that stuff. I refuse to watch it.
Right.
So, like, I want to see interesting, creative, more movies like that, you know, come out. So I'm hopeful. Like, I know we're talking about in the Black Panther podcast. I'm hopeful for the future that, you know, this kind of stuff inspires people and, you know, they're trying to do more instead of just status quo. So we'll see.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, fellas, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking about Coming to America and everything else that's relevant to that between then and now. You know, thank you, brothers, for coming on. I know you got to go, Mambo, but is there anything you want to, like, push 30 for 30 wise before you go? Anything coming out in the episodes, anything like that coming out before you go?
I mean, we just had a launch of the season on Bikram Chowdhury, which is like a Bikram yoga. That was a 5-part, you know, series. It was a binge, all came out. It was released on May 22nd.
Okay.
So I definitely would encourage people to listen to that. It's a really amazing series. It's reported and produced by my colleague, Julie Lowry Henderson. And she did an amazing job looking at this guy and his history of abuse of women in the yoga community. Mm, okay. Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal stuff. And really, like, it's hard to listen to at times, but it's really strong and it's important. It's kind of like an important story to have out there. And yeah, we got our fourth season that's going to be coming out in the fall. So look out for that. I've got a story that I'm wrapping up now that's going to be in that season. So yeah.
Okay, no doubt, man. I appreciate it.
I'm good.
Anything else you want to push before you go, Keo?
I have some stuff coming on in the future, so we'll save it for another podcast. Okay. I just feel like that. Not ready yet. Still baking.
Okay. All right. It's all good. It's all good. All right, brothers. Yeah. Baku to Kentes. Peace, brothers.
Peace out, man.
Peace,
though.
Before I wrap up the podcast today, let me share my final thoughts on Coming to America. You know, here's a movie that, you know, as I stated earlier, was epic and grand by all accounts. You know, especially when you look at the costume design. You have one of the most iconic comedians living right in the middle of his prime of his career. But what I think resonates with me is you had someone who was coming into all of his power, you know, as part of his lineage, and in his own way, he wanted to break tradition and, you know, break the rules. It wasn't just about marrying away from the traditions of, you know, the arranged marriage concept, but the whole way Akeem went about trying to live out his independence. Like I said earlier, you know, if I'm him, you know, I'm staying at the Holiday Inn or the Best Western or something at worst. Watching the movie, that's been the whole theme of, in relation to some of my podcasts in the last few months, that, you know, it's okay to go left when everybody else is going right. You know, we're living in an era now where traditional models are changing literally all around us, and in some cases being broken altogether, from technology to politics, sports, you know, music. It's just a crazy time right now. So in a small way, my thoughts are about that when I think of, you know, the movie. On top of the fact that this is one of the funniest movies of my generation, of course. Yeah, I dare you guys to disagree. And it'll go down in history as one of Eddie's iconic movies that cemented him as a legend in this genre. You know, so with that said, I hope that you enjoyed listening to this podcast as much as we enjoyed discussing the topic. And I'd like to send a special shout out to Andrew Mambo and DJ Keo for coming on the AV podcast and sharing all their thoughts and views on Coming to America. You know, that was a lot of fun, man. And just to let you know, season 3 of The Stoop, a mini podcast summer series, is approaching very soon. As I mentioned before, it's coming out in July, where we'll be ranging on different topics that I think you will all enjoy. So please, 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 please make sure you stay tuned for that. I'm looking very forward to recording those very shortly. And also, you know what else? You know what else, right? You can catch all of the South Shore AV shows wherever you listen to podcasts. You can listen to the episodes once again on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. You know, I want you to make sure you subscribe to that and to check out the Foundation website and to listen to my entire catalog of podcast shows. Make sure you subscribe to SouthShoreAV.com. Once again, that's SouthShoreAV.com. And on top of that, South Shore AV is going to be available on some more podcast apps in the near future, you know, so we're going to add to that soon enough. Once again, for Andrew Mambo and DJ Keo, this is Cal C. And you've just tuned in to the AV podcast on South Shore AV Radio. Until the next podcast, folks, peace. We out.